Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Please welcome our hosts, Paul Breitbarth and Kay Royal.
On 17 November, the Canadian Minister of Information Science and Economic Development, Navdeep Bains, introduced Bill C-11, the long-awaited update to the federal Canadian privacy legislation. For many years, this legislative update had been rumored, and now that it was finally put on the table, we can see some sweeping changes. The Digital Charter Implementation Act 2020, which includes the Consumer Privacy Protection Act, would significantly increase protections to Canadians' personal information by giving Canadians more control and greater transparency when companies handle their personal information, the minister said. Today, Serious Privacy will take a look at what the new Canadian law might bring, how it would impact companies doing business in Canada, and what novel approaches might be an inspiration for the rest of the privacy community. Joining us today are two Canadians, obviously. Jennifer Stoddart, the former Privacy Commissioner of Canada and currently Strategic Advisor in the Privacy and Cybersecurity Group at FASCN, as well as Constantine Karbaliotis, my former colleague at Nimity and now counsel at boutique law firm Innovation. Kay will only join us later in the episode, so for now you will have to make do with me. My name is Paul Breitbarth, and welcome to Serious Privacy. So without further ado, let's get to the unexpected question, because even without Kay, we'll ask the unexpected question. And for this week, I've decided upon what is the most positive that came for you out of 2020. Jennifer, can we start with you?
In privacy and cybersecurity, certainly that two important governments in Canada moved on trying to update their privacy and applicable to cybersecurity issues, that province of Quebec, and then about 5 months later, the federal government. So this is like what we've been waiting for almost a decade, I would say.
And Constantine, how about you?
Well, I'll echo that. I will say I've been probably waiting as long because I was really tired at the beginning of my career in privacy of hearing, so what's the fine as a reason for actually doing something? But actually, I point to the COVID Alert app, which the federal government and many of the provinces have adopted here as a sort of a high point because it made clear the understanding in the public's mind, the necessity for trust in gathering information, but also the importance of the gathering of personal data for those good social purposes. So I think that in the midst of all of this other terrible stuff that's going on, that there was a really key point in educating the public. And also acknowledgement from government levels, you only get data if you have trust. And that, I think, for me, was a high point. Definitely the introduction of the laws, but I think that the cultural change that has to go behind all of that, governmental, public, private sector, that's starting to take place. And that gives me great hope, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Sounds wonderful.
That's a very good observation, Constantine. I think you're quite right.
Thank you.
So for me, the most positive out of 2020, if anything at all, was that my parents got a new dog and that he is 2 days in the week staying with me. So I get to go to the beach with the dog and play with him and run around the house. And every once in a while, when I'm at work, he just comes to lay at my feet and puts his head up, asking for attention, and that makes all these Zoom calls a lot more manageable.
Must be very much in demand. That's nice.
Absolutely. So, Jennifer, you already mentioned the legislative reform is long overdue. You've been waiting for it for 10 years. Why did it take so long, in your view?
Various reasons. If you refer to either Quebec or to Canada, these are two jurisdictions that are different, of course. I think in Quebec, it didn't seem to have the need that you might see elsewhere in Canada. I don't think there was for many years as much sensitivity to online issues and how they were changing the application of the classic principle. That speeded up in the last few years. And in Canada, I think there was the idea that the principles in PIPEDA being so general and so broadly defined would allow Canada to bump along for a while until the European regulation came into force and you know, said, well, this is kind of the end of that illusion that we didn't need to modernize our legislation.
So, Constantine, can you tell us a bit more about what this law actually entails? I think it's more of a legislative package, if I understood it correctly. We see changes to PIPEDA, we see a Digital Charter Implementation Act, we see the Consumer Privacy Protection Act, we see the introduction of a new tribunal. How does it all fit together?
Well, the EDA part of PIPEDA was always a little bit of an odd sort of combination, right, with electronic documents being rolled. And so that's going to be hived off and continues on its own. The PIPA part of it is really what's being updated. So one of the major changes is that rather than relying on the Canadian Standards Association code, which was always a kind of an odd sort of way to draft legislation, was to latch on, you know, this appendix that had these principles, is now being done away with. And then so it is, in most people's view, a better piece of legislative drafting to have a code, in a sense, in one law that provides for all of the components of what I would call a modern privacy law, which is really quite important for us. It establishes, as you mentioned, and I'm always going to get the name of this wrong, the Personal Information and Data Protection, Personal Information Data Protection Tribunal, which is, I think, a very interesting balancing act. One of the things that I think distinguished Canada's approach, and that Jennifer, of course, you know, was paramount in leading, was the ombudsperson model. And it meant, notwithstanding that there wasn't a lot of fine-making or order-making ability within PIPEDA, it's astounding what we accomplished. And, you know, I'm not sucking up here, so, you know, but I'm going to call it as I see it. Our commissioners have been in large part the reason for our success internationally and why privacy has been so well embedded, notwithstanding all of the limitations that were in place. Don't forget who it was that brought Facebook and Google to heel, right? Leading the globe, you know.
Temporarily.
Well, temporarily, but, you know, still, man, and I was always of two minds. I wanted to see more powers, more order-making powers, but I also didn't want to quite lose that capacity for the commissioner to be able to serve that ombudsperson role. So what I do think is important is that this sort of delineation, I think, preserves that. It gives effective enforcement, but it also allows that sort of ethical wall between investigation, education, and, you know, the actual decision making that's going to take place in the tribunal.
So from the enforcement perspective, Jennifer, what do you like about this new law? Is it the possibility for sanctions? Is it indeed this enforcement tribunal, the private personal information data protection tribunal? Are there other things? What makes enforcement the new Canadian way even more powerful than before?
Well, I think as Constantine has said, you know, I think you have to have some kind of monetary sanctions or some kind of real downside to not following the principles of the law. And that's what notably the current Canadian law lacks. there are many good actors, there are many bad actors, and there's actors that just do what they want and you know, wait for enforcement or measurement to catch up with them. So this is certainly an advance on that. I must say, for me, the law doesn't contain many surprises. It retains the ombudsman model. It, I don't think, really gives the commissioner a lot of new avenues to exercise his attributions, but it does formalize them, Paul. You know, it maybe goes a step further in legitimating, for example, joint cooperation between our Competition Bureau, our kind of media regulatory bureau, which is very, very powerful, the CRTC. It allows the commissioner, or it says specifically the commissioner can continue on doing what he or she did, that is, cooperate with agencies abroad, cooperate with the provinces, and so on. So I'm not really surprised by a lot of what I read in this new law, but it does make it, it does put it on a more solid footing rather than leave the commissioners to go, well, there's a vacuum and nobody says, I can't do that, so I will rush in creatively to make up for the powers, the other powers that I don't have.
But that is a model that has worked in the past, obviously for Canada, also for the EDPS, which we've seen do pretty much the same until their regulation got updated a few years ago. So looking at those fines, they seem to be pretty serious. I've heard news reports saying they are the most serious among the G20. Constantine, what can you tell us? How concerned should we be?
Well, I mean, I do believe that this is what the current commissioner has been asking for, which is, you know, serious fines. I did find the 5%, you know, somewhat initially, you know, sort of confusing, because as I was saying to you earlier, it was sort of, well, we see your 4% and we raise you 1%. But as we had in conversation previously, perhaps that's just room for a little bit of negotiations in case that goes down somewhat, as was the case in Europe. I think more significant is the order to stop the processing of information. That can be done on an interim basis. And as, you know, again, as we've talked in the past about the order to see, you know, of cessation of processing that's possible in Europe, that's 100% fine. That's a very significant power. And, you know, means much more, I think, or should mean much more to Canadian organizations in terms of consequence. But it goes to the heart of being able to stop, as Jennifer's alluded to, the truly bad actors, which is, I think, important.
Would this have been something that you would have wanted to have access to, Jennifer, when in your times as commissioner, to be able to impose a processing ban, either temporarily or even indefinitely?
Yeah, Constantine's quite right to bring that up. That is an important power. However, I would think when it will be used, it will be met with considerable opposition, and this may go on through appeal to the, as I remember, the tribunal, and then perhaps on through judicial review to the federal court. Paul, can I just come back to the fines? I don't think the fines are that major. I know Minister Bain said, well, it's 5% of your global business revenue. Thank you. I'm looking at something here in French. But in fact, as I guess you discussed before I joined, there are two levels, a level of more, you know, basic fines, and then a level for deliberately flouting the law. The 5% is only at the second level, so most people or corporations who are doing the wrong thing will be covered by the first level.
Constantine, let's take a look at some of the other details of the legislation. What about legal basis? So far, Canada has been mainly following the US on a consent-driven model, if I'm correct. Is that going to change?
Well, no, I think that there is, and this is where there is some controversy or some, you know, discussion, is around consent. Consent is still the fundamental basis for the processing of information. What I find interesting in the legislation is an attempt to sort of codify what in Europe would be called legitimate interests, so that it carves out areas where consent is not required. And there is a provision that speaks to where, you know, consent would not be reasonably obtained in the circumstances, which is perhaps a little bit overbroad. There has been some concern expressed over the breadth of that exception, where it's, you know, leaves, I think, a little bit too much in the hands of the organization to decide that it's not, you know, reasonable to, you know, to get consent. So, but the consent is still one of the fundamental basis. But again, I think an attempt to sort of introduce some of the European legitimate interests notions of codifying here, if you're communicating for the purposes of, say, you know, supporting the contract or, you know, service messages, these are the kinds of things that are, of course, don't require, you know, consent. So I think it's an attempt to find a balance with, you know, consent. I'm not sure we've quite struck it in terms of, you know, maybe some of that, you know, a little bit too open-ended on the last provision, but that is still the fundamental basis. Now there is, of course, now provisions to address de-identified information. And that's where there's another area of concern, because what they haven't been terrifically clear, if information is de-identified, it shouldn't be personal, which is the approach under GDPR. But we still treat it as de-identified, as personal information, even though it's de-identified, potentially because they're trying to sort of hold some sort of, you know, control in place if there's risk of re-identification. So you have a big exception for consent in the de-identified area, but there's a little bit of murkiness that we hope, as this legislation proceeds through Parliament, that we'll get some you know, clarity around.
And what about international transfers? I recall there were some ideas floated by the Privacy Commissioner, two years ago, that there should also be more regulations in place for international transfers from Canada to third countries. Has that been included in the draft?
Well, actually, it sort of has been I find it interesting that there is a sort of an approach of plugging holes in interpretation. So what actually arose in the Equifax decision was this question of whether consent was required for data to go to the US, bluntly. And what the proposed legislation actually says is that consent is not required for, you know, to use EU terms, a controller to send data to a processor. And the law, it's referred to as a service provider. So it explicitly says consent is not required unless a service provider steps out of the bounds of what their authority is, in which case they become subject to all of the provisions associated with an organization that's collecting data, a la EU controller, right? So very similar in that regard. But I do think that there's some explicit, you know, expectations that there will be now written contracts to address the responsibilities or the accountabilities of a service provider to actually ensure that the rules flow with the data, which I think is the general direction of, you know, most data protection authorities. I think there will be greater constraints, but still the general philosophy, I think, is not to inhibit international data flows, but to create accountabilities around it.
Mm-hmm. Can I just point out that this was the law and is the law as interpreted now, that much of the business sector was alarmed by the reinterpretation of the present law a couple of years ago in the Equifax affair. And I'm very interested to see that the Canadian government has chosen to stay with this kind of more flexible accountability approach, where the data controller has to bind the processor to following Canadian privacy standards. Now, how this will meet the test of the European inspectors who look at adequacy, I don't know. This has not been the approach in Quebec, which I have criticized publicly. And I think, Paul, that those who are listening to this podcast have to understand that Canada is in a much different geographical and commercial context than the European Union. We have a very small internal market, so a lot of our goods and services are exported. We live beside the United States, and certainly the English-speaking part of Canada shares a lot of cultural traits with the United States. And doing as in the Quebec law is currently asked, evaluating the adequacy, the equivalency of the laws of every jurisdiction to which you might export, not only data, but just the data that flows with a lot of Canada's weavers. We export a lot of, you know, pigs and cows and timber and mining, ore and so on, wheat. But with all those exports goes the minimal personal information of those who are involved in the process.
Of course.
I think it's completely impractical for the North American economy. So we'll see what Quebec does with this on one hand. On the other hand, will the European Union continue to understand, as it did in 2001 when it first gave adequacy to Canada, that we are in a different geographical and cultural context than the European Union, albeit with the same good intentions?
I think to some extent that will depend on the regulation of onward transfers from Canada to the United States on the one hand, and on the other hand, maybe also on the surveillance legislation in Canada. Canada is, of course, one of the Five Eyes, together with the UK and the US and Australia and New Zealand, which has become increasingly a concern for many of the Europeans following the Schrems decisions. And to be honest, I'm not too familiar with the Canadian surveillance legislation yet. That's something to be looked into the first quarter of next year. So I have no idea how your protections and safeguards have been put in place and whether or not they would apply to every single individual, no matter where they live and what their nationality is, or whether you need the US concept of standing to even be able to go to court and be able to prove that your data was actually processed instead of making a claim if you only suspect that something happens. But I think that will all be weighed as part of the adequacy review. We had expected those to be published already, but of course, Schrems 2 delayed those as well. And there are by now 17 months left before the renewal of the adequacy decision needs to be taken.
Mm-hmm. So adequacy is something Jennifer and I have talked about probably more than adequately over the last few years. So there's two things. One, we can look to the experience of Japan, because they got their adequacy recognition limited to exclude onward transfers. Why? Because they were under cross-border privacy rules and the Europeans didn't feel that that was adequate enough to provide the right protections. So we may find that we're in somewhat of the same boat. And, you know, Jennifer, I suspect you're far more knowledgeable on the surveillance sort of question. But my sense is that we do have a different legal environment than the U.S., that the oversight from the judiciary is much stronger, that the tendency to leverage or utilize fishing expedition kind of approaches is much less here. And that, well, the pronouncements of our Supreme Court have gone a long way, I think, to embedding this notion of privacy as a fundamental human right. So I do think that we have a slightly different picture than the U.S. And there's no question that it could be bolstered, I suspect, for the benefit of Canadians as much as for, you know, maintaining our adequacy. But Jennifer, I'm be curious to know what you'd say.
Yeah, I think those are all very good points. I'm not familiar with the new surveillance law. I forget exactly what it's called, but we do have a new commissioner, and who is a very, very well-regarded British Columbia lawyer and MP in his past life, who has far more powers than the existing judge had, and certainly than I ever had, when people would say, well, what does the privacy commissioner think of everything that Snowden alleged? Well, you know, I couldn't say much because I didn't have very much power to do anything about what the security establishment did. So we do have that new person in a very capable person in the mix. And I hope that will make a difference in the perception of the rights we give to people, individuals under our system.
So one of the ideas that has been floated in the past and most recently by Colin Bennett is a potential accession of Canada to the Council of Europe Convention 108 or 108 plus by now on the protection of personal data. I know that it has been discussed by Canada before. It has also been discussed with the Council of Europe, and Colin Bennett now says this is the right time for Canada to actually accede to that convention. We discussed it last week when we spoke to Sophie Quasny from the Council of Europe in this very podcast, and she thought it would be a good idea to forward that question to you as well. What do you think? Should Canada accede to Convention 108? Would that be helpful?
Paul, I all the time during the years I was commissioner, I tried to promote the idea of Canada acceding to Convention 108. Apparently, at one time before, just before I became commissioner, so that's pre-2003, the Department of Justice used to send a lawyer to attend the meetings, and he was very much appreciated. And then they stopped. And certainly, the people from the Council of Europe would show up in other fora, notably the OECD, where Canada is quite active. So I was very pleased to work with Sophie Quasny in you know, various venues. And I personally never got an answer why Canada would not join Convention 108. It seems, you know, it seems to have not many downsides and to be a relatively, you know, positive thing. But if you can get on your podcast somebody from the Department of Justice or, you know, External Affairs, you might get closer to an answer.
I can imagine that there would be, of course, our standard federal provincial sort of, you know, how do we do this, actually implement this? How do we commit to a treaty? Because I have, you know, I'm pretty certain that there would have to be some implementing legislation. Certainly the federal government would be able to do, but then that would also maybe have to apply to the provinces. And we haven't even begun to talk about, you know, the division of federal and provincial, you know, sort of authorities here and how that touches on adequacy. I would say, being that I'm in the role of advising Canadian clients about doing business with Europe and with American companies that are bringing data from Europe. So it is broader than just simply, you know, direct EU to Canada transfers. It would be really nice to have Convention 108 take this issue off the table, because this is well beyond most small, medium organizations' capacity. To your point earlier, Jennifer, about Quebec requiring a data transfer impact assessment in every situation, it's also beyond, you know, it's beyond most organizations to keep doing that. And also then to have to assess, you know, our own law versus, you know, the US versus, you know, the EU's. I see it as a complexity. I would love for governments to take this off the table. I mean, this is one of the underlying reasons why Safe Harbor and Privacy Shield failed. These are all beyond our pay grade to fix. And it would be really nice for the governments of, you know, the Western world to settle on something. And if Convention 108 gets us through this hurdle, then that would be absolutely amazing from a business standpoint. I see it as structural to enable those free flows of information.
Yeah, well, maybe there's a bit of realignment happening in the Western world. So maybe this will come to pass. I don't know.
Dare we hope?
We can always hope, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. It's the season for hope.
Constantine, you just mentioned the interplay between the federal legislation and the provincial legislation, which is quite different from the relation between the U.S. federal government and the states. I take it the way Canada was formed as well. But how would this draft legislation that's on the table now, that Bill C-11, will that have any impact in the provinces apart from forming a framework, of course, for businesses to work with? Are the provinces required to align their own legislation with this new law, or will that remain completely independent?
Well, substantial similarity has always been the test within Canada, and that was, it's continued. So the real question, I guess, is could the, just like the European Union has to now reassess adequacy based on the changes that GDPR wrought, do we now need to say, okay, we now have a new baseline, and do we need to reestablish that sort of substantial similarity requirement. I do believe conversations are probably being undertaken between the provinces and the federal government on this point because, you know, and I've made this point in writings that I've done and conversations we've had, you know, the purpose for GDPR is also to enable the free flow of data within the European Union. Maybe we should be taking the same approach in Canada. We are a common market. And, you know, there have been studies that the Bank of Canada and others have released that shows our own interprovincial barriers contribute to potentially a loss of 4% of our GDP, which is crazy when you think about it. We're one country. So it really is, you know, we have the example of the United States, you know, making multitudes of laws and making it difficult for business. Why would we follow that? Why wouldn't we have a consistent approach? And I do know that the digital charter initially was brought as a way of sort of providing a set of, you know, foundational principles. And I do agree with that concept. And I think that the business community as well is going to pressure all levels of government to be in alignment. We've been blessed. I keep, you know, again, it sounds like I'm sucking up, but I'm not. That the commissioners on the whole reached. Yeah, I know. But I'm one of her fan club. So the point is, you know, we've been lucky because the commissioners, despite different provincial laws and even different legal system in Quebec, have tended to end up in the same place in terms of how we interpret how privacy should be done. So we, by and large, and that may be one of the virtues of a principles-based approach, is you have, you know, that maneuverability. It would be nice to maintain that and, in fact, enhance that, because I think that one of the main things we should be looking for, not adequacy is not the sole goal here. It should be to create a robust privacy law. And given this is coming from the Ministry of Innovation, Science, and Economic Development, maybe one of the key concepts here is it should foster that digital economy, right? So I do think that it's going to put pressure. I was also going to add, Jennifer, to what you're talking about. Ontario initially initiated a consultation as well about a private sector privacy law. So we are looking, I think, at provinces generally looking at maybe updating their regimes. You know, it'd be so nice for them to actually just collaborate for a change. You know, maybe handling the COVID crisis created a bit of a precedent. The CBC commented that we didn't have this level of cooperation between the governments in World War II. So, you know, I dare hope we might have that spirit of cooperation continue.
Jennifer, how do you think about that provincial cooperation? You've done quite a lot of it. So how do you see that developing going forward?
I certainly did a lot of it. It takes a lot of will. And the commissioners are not politically aligned. They're not elected officials in our system, but they do generally reflect or tend to have to take into account the government, the wishes of the government of the day. Otherwise, they would be their own kind of powers, which is not. So it's a very, very delicate line to tread. And it takes people who want to work together. One of the things I noticed in the new obligations of the commissioner is that she or he has to report in their annual report on the application of the substantially similar laws in the province. First of all, what laws there are, and secondly, how they're applied. That seems to me to be a bit of a potential hornet's nest, because, you know, that's a very delicate task, is weighing an opinion on laws by a federal official on laws passed by a provincial government. And then perhaps in spite of a lot of good work, the organization doesn't really have the funds to really apply it adequately. I was very surprised at that. But again, I think it comes back to trying to preempt a European assessment of Canada as being so disparate, so such a patchwork, that it's hard to come to a notion of Canada globally, although subnational entities can be judged adequate or not. So there's a lot that's kind of up for grabs, and there's a lot there that that could be latched onto in different ways to further various agendas in the future.
I was going to say that's very interesting. I missed most of the conversation. I apologize for that, but I like that assessment.
Any questions that you had that were burning on your mind?
You probably already covered any questions burning on my mind, but I guess the ones that come up for me is with the proposed Canadian law. If y'all haven't covered that in depth already, the idea of the appellate tribunal.
We haven't covered it in detail yet, so go ahead.
Oh, yeah, that's beautiful. So in the DICA, is that what they're calling it?
There's a P in there, I think, somewhere, but one second.
In the proposed law, they had the idea of the enforcement in there, which I think the penalties are amazing. I mean, they seem to be structured after the GDPR. That's pretty strong. But there's also the idea of appellate tribunal from the OPC. And I find this very interesting. Do you have any insight into the drivers behind that level of penalty structure or the appellate tribunal?
Well, I think that the fine structure is meant to, you know, and I jokingly said before you came in, you know, we raise you 1%, Europe. And I think it's, again, to make the fines substantial enough that, well, what's the real purpose behind it? It's to get the board of directors' attention, to get executives' attention. We were discussing earlier that the ability to, you know, compel, you know, processing of information to stop is actually perhaps even more frightening, should be more frightening.
Well, it is, but yet people don't pay attention to that. You try to tell everyone this and they're like, oh, but the fines. And we're like, I'm sorry, stick the fines.
Yeah, the fines are important because they actually are what, you know, frankly, the executive pays attention to.
Right.
And we need to be able to package this and get their attention so that the right resources are, you know, allocated to address this. So the administrative penalty, you know, sort of provisions, which is, I think it's actually 2% versus 4, is really intended to, you know, deal with, you know, as Jennifer was describing the earlier, not the, you know, the bad actors. But those are always maximums. And, you know, the European experience is, very rarely are we going to those numbers, right? I mean, they're careful not to overdo it and make sure that the fines, I think, are proportionate to the harm. I think that there's still some things that we need to know. There is a private right of action, which if order of the commissioner is not challenged or if it's upheld by this tribunal, that gives a private right of action. So there's a barrier. It's not quite as free as in the US. Maybe that's, again, the Canadian style.
Right.
But there's also some, you know, concern that maybe that there's too much administrative burden before you can get to a civil right of action.
But having a private right of action is also huge because, one, adding in the additional individual rights definitely says that they are marketing this law towards the European idea and to remain adequate when that comes up for review. And focusing on the individual rights, the individual ability to redress, which is where I think the tribunal comes in at, is reinforcing that idea of redress for individual rights and enforcing your rights.
Executives pay attention to you can get sued.
Exactly. The money. You know, it's all about the bottom dollar, which I didn't anticipate for Canada.
Well, you know, again, you know, we typically, you know, being Canadians, we do what you guys do, but we regulate it.
But colder.
So Jennifer, what does the process look like from here? I mean, we have a draft. When will we see an act?
Oh, Paul, that's a good question.
Take out your crystal ball.
Yes, I don't know that any date has been announced for parliamentary hearings.
Okay.
The minister said there would be consultation. That could take a long time. So depending on what the, you know, the pushback against this might be, maybe Constantine has some more information, but, you know, it's kind of up in the air for the moment. In the normal course of things, it would go to parliamentary, to commission.
Okay.
Over the winter, spring, but
And we, of course, have the pandemic in the background. So, you know, mm-hmm. there are some priorities for the government. Mm-hmm. We also have a minority government. So, you know, it is conceivable that at some point, you know, if there was a non-confidence motion, we could face an election. However unwise I think that would be, given the current pandemic. On the positive side, every party
well,
in the
hey,
last...
Constantine, it's not like we're doing unwise things at the moment.
No, no, not at all.
Changing government during a pandemic can be helpful.
It's, well, you know, sometimes. But on the whole, I think that the appetite in this country is not to go generally to the polls right now. But the other side, which is a positive, I think, is that every political party in the last election had as part of its platform updating our privacy regime. So it would be, I think, you know, contrary to their stated positions. And I think also ISED has done a fairly good job of basically, you know, with annoying both ends, and other people have commented about this, going right down the middle, they've made it, we can live with it kind of sort of approach, which means that it's more likely to get passed. And therefore, we'll see, you know, some action. So I think there will also be, the minister has commented, an 18-month transition period. So it's not like it's going to suddenly dump on companies. There are also, and this is significant too, because a lot is put into regulation in this act mm-hmm. that isn't been articulated yet. So,
right.
And there is a concern that, you know, the balance between business interests and personal, you know, privacy as a personal and human right might be eroded by things that might be done via regulation. I don't frankly buy that, because I think that everyone has been very careful to do that truly Canadian thing of finding the middle ground. And, you know, yes, there are some details I'd love to see sorted out, like given the potential for the size of the fines, how should that private right of action work? Could be devastating to a company, right? And we really want people, as Jennifer said in the facts past, to fix things, to do things the right way, not to, you know, end organizations. So I do think that there are some details that need to be addressed in the regulations. And I think that, however, I would say, I think also that this is an opportunity. You know, one of my favorite topics, Paul and Jennifer, is this code of conduct kind of idea.
Right.
Codes of practice are there. And here's where all of those objections from different industry groups could be addressed. Come up with a code of practice.
Yep, absolutely.
That would be the way to create certainty in this, and rules appropriate to your industry and to the nature of the data that you're collecting. If you're concerned about this, then present something that would actually provide a framework for you and your industry to be able to be a bit more prescriptive than we can be in the law, and tell people what to do. Because it just, that's the key thing. We got to tell people what they should do. That's what they want.
I'm sitting here laughing, Constantine, because of course you want a prescriptive set of this you can do and this you can't do. You like that clear division of yes and no rules. I love it. I love the idea of a certification mechanism. Of course, being with TrustArc, I love the idea of a certification mechanism, but a global data protection certification mechanism for principles, maybe the OECD principles or something along that line that we talked about last time would be great. But I do know we're over time, and I'm sorry I joined late. I'll pick up on the unexpected question that I think the most positive thing that came out of 2020 was Kamala Harris being elected vice president. I'm sorry. I'm going to stick to that. She's been a privacy love of mine for years, so I'm going to stick to that one. I love it. And then I don't have any final questions since we're after time, but thank y'all so much for joining us. And I apologize that I came in late. Apparently, it was a fascinating conversation, so I look forward to listening to the recordings and going through those.
Okay, and you know that Kamala Harris went to school about 10 minutes walk away from where I'm sitting, so there must be a Canadian influence somewhere.
Absolutely. And with that, we conclude our penultimate episode for 2020. If you like our series, please do tell your friends and colleagues about us and rate and review us in your podcast application. Should you have any questions or suggestions, please reach out to us via seriousprivacy@trustark.com or via Twitter @podcastprivacy. You will find Kay on Twitter as Heart of Privacy and myself as EuroPolB. Thank you again for listening to Serious Privacy, and until our next and final episode of this season one, goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.